All right. Hey there, this is Bram Kanstein and you're listening to Bitcoin for Millennials. Together with my guests on this podcast, I go on a journey to discover how our current financial system works, why it's flawed, and why Bitcoin is the most relevant technology that you should understand and adopt. In this episode, I'm joined by Fred Krueger. He's a Bitcoin investor, professional trader, and entrepreneur with 10 successful exits. He holds a math PhD from Stanford and is a Wall Street veteran, having worked there in the 80s and 90s. He shares his opinions on Bitcoin on his popular X and recently created a YouTube channel and never shies away of a discussion with other investors. So I'm happy to talk with him today. Welcome, Fred.
Thank you, Bram.
Awesome to be here. Thank you. Yeah, it's awesome to meet people that I just know from Twitter. So that's always fun.
Same.
Yeah, so I have some questions for you. But first, I wanted to ask, like, how do you experience talking about Bitcoin with your generational peers? Like, do you still try to educate them? Like, what's your experience there?
I mean, most of them have given up on, are not open to the idea of Bitcoin. So I would say most people that I worked with on Wall Street, very few of them have any interest at all in it. And most people think it's just some kind of Ponzi scheme. And it's bullshit, basically.
Interesting.
That's kind of what most people think in my age bracket. But there are some notable exceptions, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, we have Larry Lepard, right? I think.
Yeah. Well, for example, Larry, I mean, he's very rare that people coming from the gold background transition to Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
I think most people kind of, and once they're into gold for 20 years, they stay with gold. They don't transition.
Yeah.
So well, I would say, but I just think in general, people who have done well in the kind of the fiat world, right? They stay in the fiat world, and it's kind of rare to kind of change your mindset. Now Larry Fink has changed his mindset on Bitcoin. But,
yeah, I think so, yeah.
Yeah, so it's not impossible, right? But it's definitely not the normal thing, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I tweeted before, like, for me, people, well, also like Greg Foss, you know, I think Greg has in his bio, like, 35 years in a risk chair, he says.
Right.
And then I think, well, I'm 35, you know, what do I know? Is then like kind of my take there, right? Like that I find it so interesting that like what you said, like people who've been in that world for a very long time, the fact that they can turn around almost a 180, right, and adopt Bitcoin, I think for me personally, that's a really big signal, because it's a really big like personal challenge, as you said, you know, like it's difficult to do.
Yeah, and I think a lot of them, even if they are accepting of it, they're accepting of it to the, you know, 5% of their portfolio kind of accepting of it. You know what I mean? Mm. They're not full on Bitcoiners.
Yeah.
So I think it's really tough, you know, when you've made it's easier when you haven't made a lot of money, right? But when you've made a bunch of money, for you to send millions of dollars to Coinbase to buy Bitcoin.
Yeah, as well.
You know, that's just, it's a tough thing. I did it, but it's tough. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like it's tough getting there. It's a lot easier if you bought it sort of cheaply and you just saved and it went up, you know?
Yeah. And so how do you now look back on like your Wall Street career and now that you understand and know about Bitcoin, like how do you look back, but also how did you get introduced to Bitcoin?
Well, I mean, I bought my first Bitcoin in 2013, right? Mm. So I saw it, you know, I'm a tech guy, so I saw it pretty early and I bought some, but I didn't think of it as being any more than just kind of a joke, really, you know, sort of like, okay, this is some kind of sort of interesting, vaguely interesting thing. I'll buy a few. It's, see how it goes. And then I bought it and then I sold it, you know, so.
Same. Yeah.
Yeah. So like, I didn't really think of it as being, you know, like I thought the chance of it taking off was pretty low, you know, and it really took for me until 2019 before I really kind of, got it, I would say, certainly, I've been around it. I knew people around it. Friends of mine were into it, but it didn't sort of click for me personally to the point where, okay, actually going to go out and buy a bunch of this thing. You know what I mean? Like that. And I think that's a personal thing. It's just like who you talk to, what it clicks for you. A lot of people have different, roads into it, right? It might be some kind of economic thing. Like you think that inflation is going to take over. That wasn't really it for me, but, I sort of got it in 2019. That's kind of, and then, after that I was sort of orange pilled and I added more, sort of like, right around, a little bit 1 year before Sailor,
Well, you beat Sailor. Well, I have the same path, I think, and that is also what I like to, explore also in this podcast, because as you said, it's this personal discovery, right? Like I am also into Bitcoin from 2013. I bought at 400, I sold at 4,000, I felt great. But now I have less Bitcoin than before, I saw all tweets of myself tweeting when it went to $100. I saw myself tweet it was a digital commodity, and I was like, damn, I got it, but I didn't get it. I understood it to some degree, but I didn't.
Well, I think the big thing for me, which is, I was really concerned right up until 2018 that something else was going to win, because I think that everybody in tech always sort of has this mentality that, MySpace is going to get displaced by Facebook, that AOL is going to get displaced by Yahoo, which is going to get displaced by Google. Mm-hmm. So we think of it as just pure technology, and you're always sort of thinking, well, there's something better that's going to come along, Why would I bet on this particular thing when there's something, this is slow, expensive, maybe there's going to be fast and cheap that comes along, I was really of that opinion that fast and cheap would win over slow and expensive.
Yeah. Well, TCP IP didn't get replaced, right? Like it's more on that level.
Yeah. To look at it. I mean, but there's a lot of other cryptocurrencies, right? So, there wasn't a lot of TCP IP competitors.
That's true.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. But you do see the difference now, right?
So I definitely think that that's, and I think still a lot of people on Wall Street just fundamentally, even if they say they're pro Bitcoin, fundamentally, they may be like, well, wait a second, maybe Solana is going to take over Avalanche or something. They really fundamentally, they're open to that idea.
Yeah. I think that takes time to understand as to like which layer does this belong to, right? Should I look at this as a technology or as a startup creating a token that is fueling a certain ecosystem, or is Bitcoin just a totally different?
Right. I mean, I think it's sort of, I think if you think of this thing as payment, as a payment technology, you're missing it, right? You will miss it. You will miss the what it is, right? Because you're like, okay, well, Venmo does really well. Venmo does pretty good. It works. PayPal works, and maybe stable coins are better than using Bitcoin, because, stable coins is the dollar. It's, if you're in Venezuela, the dollar seems pretty good. You know what I mean? So. Yeah. I think that the problem is, I think payment tech, you miss it. And I think the hard thing is realizing that it actually is a new form of money. And it's a new unit of account. And that's really the hard part, because, I think it's very counterintuitive why do we need a new unit of account? It's not clear, like living in America in particular, or Netherlands, right?
Yeah.
Why do I need to start, going from, the euro to this weird unit of account called Bitcoin? Why? you know.
Hey there, thanks so much for listening to this episode. I just really want to ask you for a quick favor. Over the last few months, I've seen that only 75% of people who listen to this podcast or watch it on YouTube are actually subscribed. The most important thing I'm currently focusing on, next to hopefully giving you interesting conversations, is growing this podcast subscriber base so I can continue with it into the future. I want to thank everyone who has been viewing and listening to Bitcoin for Millennials, leaving comments here and sending me DMs. It's been super, super motivating. So thank you so much. So I really want to ask you to please hit the subscribe button on YouTube or follow me on your favorite podcasting app if you are enjoying this podcast. Thanks again for joining me on this journey. Now back to the conversation. Well, that was actually my next question. Like, what do you think is the main thing people need to learn before they can understand Bitcoin? Is it that the money that they are forced to use is not really designed to work for them? Or like, what would you say?
Well,
there?
Look, I've thought about it. Now my thesis is this, is that I think there's a couple things that Bitcoin does much better than regular money, right? And the first thing I think it does is it allows your money to be held in custody by yourself and moved wherever you want, right? And, you know, if you have euros and you move to America, your euros are basically useless. You know, we do not accept the euro over here, right?
Yeah.
The dollar, my dollars in Netherlands are pretty useless, you know. But Bitcoin is this unit where I can hold my Bitcoin in a wallet, and I can take that wallet anywhere I want in the world, right? And that's a fundamentally new thing. And I think that's actually the killer app of Bitcoin, right? Is that it's sort of it's money that you can transport, you can hold, and you can move around the world, right? That's the first thing. I think it's just, and nothing has this, because fiat really has to be stored in a bank account, right?
Yeah.
And then there's some third party that's kind of gating it. Bitcoin can be stored, you know, just in a wallet, right? And so that's the first thing. The second thing is, you know, I can send Bitcoin anywhere to anybody, anywhere in the world without an intermediary either, right? So I don't need a checkbook to send it. I don't need a wire to send it. I can send it to anybody in the world. And again, that's a really new thing, right? Now, other cryptocurrencies have that capability, as they have the capability of the wallet, right? But I would think those two things are the thing that are the biggest capabilities of crypto in general, right? And mm-hmm. then the third thing is, you know, this sort of finite supply, right? So, you know, it cannot be debased. And I think between those things, I think you have something that is extremely powerful. And it's extremely powerful for people to keep their money out of the reach of the government.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is the biggest, that's the core driver of Bitcoin's growth. Number one driver is, I want to take my money and I want to move it outside of the banking system. I want to move it outside of the government system. And
how much do you think people should understand that, like what you said, the finite supply, but also the issuance, right? It cannot be debased. Like that they have to understand how that is enforced, right? With all the incentives within the miners and
right.
And
so I think there's sort of two things, right? One is understanding crypto in general, right? Because Bitcoin works the same as all other cryptos, more or less, right? Whether it's Ethereum or anything, right? You have a wallet.
In usage, yes. In usage.
Yeah, in terms of the usage, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also, why is this particular one special, right?
Yes, exactly.
That's really the... So the first thing is just, do you understand wallets? And do you understand seed phrases? And do you understand those things? Now that's a first step, right? So people have to get over that hump. Not obvious, right? Because like people don't understand, where is my Bitcoin? Is it stored inside the ledger somewhere? Is it like people don't understand that, right? They have a hard time even understanding what it is. that is
well,
being
they're
stored.
Comparing it to an existing experience, right? Their their concept is the money I see in my banking app
concept
is
actually the wallet.
At my bank.
Here's a wallet, you know?
Yeah.
This wallet has, I don't have any dollars in this wallet, but it can't have dollars. So if they leave, they're either in the wallet, they're out of the wallet, yes. But they're not in two wallets at the same time, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That doesn't exist with cash, right? It's in one wallet. But Bitcoin can be in three wallets at the same time. So, you know, I think that's from a conceptual level, a lot of people just don't understand that. And I think it takes a while to really understand that, to be honest. I don't, you know, I think a lot of people, and Bitcoin is particularly tricky because they change you change the addresses. You know, the setup of Bitcoin is a little odd, you know, I would say.
Yeah, there's so many layers to understanding as to why
there's a lot of subtleties to what Bitcoin is, right?
Yeah.
So I think, you know, it takes a certain takes a while, but then there's sort of the okay, well, why is this different from say Solana, right? Well, there's no company behind it. There's no Solana Foundation. Bitcoin, there is kind of Bitcoin Foundation, but there's no foundation that's in charge of Bitcoin, right? So there's nobody who says, well, you know, we're going to change the rules of Bitcoin. We're going to do this. So that's another whole layer that I think people get really, they have a hard time with. And I think, you know, I mean, honestly, not that many people really understand it, to be honest.
Yeah,
but they understand that they do understand that the price is going up. And they understand that people are saying this is the one. And so, you know, and they listen to people like you and me, you know, and they're like, okay, these guys seem to be passionate about it. They seem to, you know, be articulating that this is different from some other cryptocurrency. So, you know.
And so how would you explain why this is such a big concept and the future of money? Like, why should people pay attention? I saw you tweet, you know, like something along the lines, and I'm maybe butchering, but, you know, like, you have to pay attention. Like, you cannot miss this. Like, if you're missing this now, it's just your own, like,
right. Well,
not
look,
paying
I mean,
attention,
I think that,
you know?
You know, it's if we're right, right? If we Bitcoiners are right, and I think we are, right? But, like, you know, if this is going to become the future world money, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then if you don't get involved at year 15 of the future of world money, you kind of miss pretty much the biggest thing that's going to change the world economy, you know, going forward. I don't see anything that's going to be bigger than that, right? Because if the entire money supply changes to a world where we're running Bitcoin, and if that happens within the next, say, 20 years, well, the difference between you not getting involved now and getting involved 20 years from now is, I mean, it's going to be completely night or day as to kind of whether you retire, for example. You know what I mean? You still may retire, but, you know, it's an amazing opportunity, right? What?
I wanted to say not as advertised.
Not as advertised.
Retire,
right.
But
I mean,
not as advertised.
You can still survive. I mean, I think you'll do fine, but, like, you know, it's probably the single biggest wealth creation event for people, especially your age, is there's going to be one decision. Did they get orange pilled or not?
Yeah.
You know,
so why do you think it's so hard for people? I totally agree. What I sometimes think is the fact that we are living in a time where something so big is developing, that's already hard for people to, like, get, right? Like, big things that happened in history, they are history. We read about them, right? They seem far away from us. We seem far removed from that. But the fact that we are actually living through it, I think sometimes that's also what drives people to kind of like ignoring it or saying like, yeah, well, you're talking in this big way. That doesn't really make sense, right? They are not able to wrap their head around the fact that this is the invention of a new, better money, basically, right? And something that creates...
Which is sort of the cornerstone of kind of, you know, government, economics, business, everything, right?
Yes,
so,
exactly.
You know, that's the thing is like, you said, well, so what? Money, okay. So it's like a new PayPal. Okay, that's not going to change the world, right? A new PayPal is not going to change the world, right? But a new thing where everybody's going to be stuck to the system of like really honest money where governments can't print and where, you know, everybody who does go into debt is going to, you just can't keep on racking up debts forever either. That's fundamentally going to change everything. So I think it's hard to, I think it, you can understand that it's going to happen, but I think it's so revolutionary that I think most people think, yeah, it can't possibly happen. But not in my lifetime, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they're like, yeah. And I think, you know, I was having this conversation on Spaces with some people from Europe, from England. And they're like, well, you know, a lot of people in Europe sort of believe that the government's going to take care of them, right? Like, the government's going to provide my pension. The government's going to do this. Government's going to take care of me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that's probably an incorrect assumption. You know, we're seeing that in the same thing in the U.S. You know, government's going to pay for my Social Security. No, the government's not going to. There will not be any Social Security. That's just a lie, you know. Mm. You're paying for it.
In America for the next 300 years, probably, or maybe longer. Sorry? In America, probably for the next 300-400 years, if you look at, you know, how many trillion of unfunded liabilities.
Yeah, I mean,
right?
They just can't pay it. That's never going to be paid. And those Medicare benefits and the Social Security benefits are not, they do not have money for that. Mm. And so the system is kind of bankrupt, but we're all pretending that it's not.
Yeah.
And so there's got to be a fundamental change to the system. And that change is coming, and Bitcoin's going to be part of that change, right? So it's a really big change, and I think a lot of people would rather, you know, it's a little bit like thinking about your own death, right? It's not particularly pleasant thinking that you're not going to be around, you know, 100 years from now. But you're not going to be around 100 years from now. You know what I mean?
Well, and it doesn't make it less true, right? So your feeling about it doesn't make the
feeling. You're still... There's nobody has ever lived beyond 123 years old. That's the maximum a human being. And, you know, we've had, you know, 10 billion of us kind of walk the earth, and nobody's lived beyond 123 that in recorded history. And look, I think this system is also going to fail. And you know, if not thinking about it doesn't make it not happen. So it's going to happen, and kind of Bitcoin's your solution, you know. And you know, it's just a question of how much do you want to hedge your bets. Maybe you sort of say, well, okay, Fred, I kind of 10% believe you. Okay, great. Well, 10%'s probably enough. You don't need to be 100% believer. You know, you need to be a little bit of a believer. You know,
yeah,
we're still sufficiently early that if you kind of believe a little bit, I think you're going to be okay.
Yeah.
You don't have to put all your eggs in the Bitcoin basket. But, you know, it really makes no sense to have no coins, I think, at this point.
Yeah. I think the fact that this is so big combined with the weird perception of people that it's too late and all these things, that I think that makes a lot of people not pay attention, right? Like, well, because Bram and Fred are talking about it. Yeah, they're only talking about it because they have Bitcoin. By the way, I always then think, right, of course, that is my skin in the game. It would be weird if I didn't have Bitcoin and talked about how good Bitcoin was. But anyway, but the point is more like people think they are too late, but how are you too late to a new money, right? And that kind of ties into like how big well,
I think,
can you
think,
you
know, look,
like
I
how
think
far
part
can
of,
you zoom out?
I think part of the thing is, look, it's hard without looking at sort of quantitative numbers of how much this is catching on, you know? And that's one of the things I've been kind of doing on Twitter recently is I've really been focusing on kind of trying to explain to people about these power laws, and not just about power laws of price, but like power laws of adoption, right? So, you know, Bitcoin at the end of the day, it is growing almost exponentially. It's growing like a weed. Okay.
Yeah.
And basically, you know, 25% a year, there's more Bitcoin users every year. And it doesn't matter whether Bitcoin's going, price is going up or down, the usage is increasing, right? And there's all these ways of measuring that. You can measure people who have one Bitcoin or people who have one-tenth of a Bitcoin or addresses that have a hundredth of a Bitcoin or even addresses that have 10 Bitcoin. And you see these things are growing at sort of a geometric rate, right? And so there's, you know, it really is, there is no uncertainty about it. It's just, this thing's growing. It's sort of like population growth in a country like, you know, India, right? Mm-hmm. Population growth in Netherlands is not growing, but population in India is growing, or Mexico, that's growing every year. It's growing at, you know, whatever, 7% a year. Yeah. And, you know, I think we're dealing with sort of an inevitability of the growth and adoption of Bitcoin. That's really the basis. Now, this is also growing in terms of price. It's also growing in a very consistent way, but it's a little harder to really appreciate and understand that because it's happening in this logarithmic kind of way. And we have very bad intuition for logarithmic growth.
Can you explain a bit on that? Like
what is the main thing to
understand?
Let's just say if people, like if you ask most people who are not in Bitcoin or even people who are in Bitcoin, you say, explain the price of Bitcoin. They'd be like, well, there was back in the day, a long, long time ago, Bitcoin was really cheap, right? Like you were saying, right? In 2013, it was like a couple hundred dollars, right? You can buy Bitcoin for $200, right? And then, so there was this prehistory where it was very cheap. And then in 2017, it kind of went from $1,000 to $20,000, right? Almost $20,000. Then it crashed. And then it was like dead. And then it went in late 2020, it rose again from the dead and it went to $60,000. And then it stayed there for about a year, went down and went back up. It hit 60,000, 69,000 in the second peak. Then it crashed. And then it did nothing for 3 years. It died. And then last year it went back up. Well, that doesn't sound like a straight line at all, right? Like
no.
That's sort of like sounds like a very risky kind of investment that probably too risky for most people, right? Like especially somebody my age, right? They'd be like, yeah, I don't need that. That sounds like way too much volatile, just complete risky casino, you know? But if you look at it on logarithmic space and you say, great, let's look at the logarithm of Bitcoin price, right? Which the logarithm is a good way that you can put a graph of Bitcoin price over a very wide time scale, right? So from when Bitcoin was at 10 cents, right? So the logarithm is -1 at 10 cents, right? To right now where Bitcoin, let's say it's roughly $100,000, not quite 100,000 yet, but you know, 100,000 would be 10 to the power 6. So the logarithm of it in base 10 is 6. So you went from -1 to +6, right?
Yeah.
So you look at that. And now the trick is look at time also on a logarithmic basis. So look at time starting at the Genesis block and 15 years from there. So 10 years that's one, right? Because 10 to the power 1, 10 to the power one is 10, right? And so, you know, you start at zero, you go to a little bit beyond one. Now you're at, you know, 1.4, right? Or 1.3, you know. And so if you look at time that way and logarithm price, now you see, whoa, it's a complete straight line.
Yeah.
It's very clear. Once you see it, you're like, I can't unsee that. It's completely a straight line. And now it wobbles around the straight line, but it's very clear that it's growing linearly. Not possible that it's random, right?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, there's not, you know, not that many people have seen that graph, including not that many Bitcoiners, right?
Yeah.
And so once you see that graph, you're like, oh, that's odd. Why is this thing that went up from 10 cents to 100,000? So it went up seven orders of magnitude, right?
Yeah.
How could something that grew up in such a consistent way? And the answer is it's a power law. It's part of these power laws that exist in nature all over the place, right?
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
Sorry to ask a question about it. Like I'm talking to Giovanni Santastasi in 2 days, so that's great. So we'll dive deeper. But I think the essence of the power law is like I think there's a great example, and I want to say it correctly, but I think it's like the like how the size of the heart of an animal is correlated to its weight or its size in a certain way, right? Like that eventually.
Yeah. So if you look at
stuff like that,
the mass of an animal, right?
Mm.
Measured in kilograms, right?
Yeah.
And you measure the logarithm of the mass of an animal. And on the other axis, you put the metabolic rate, which is how much energy does that animal need to stay alive, right?
Yeah.
Well, it turns out you need 100 watts to stay alive.
Mm.
So you require, you and I both require about the same amount of energy as a light bulb to keep going, right?
Yeah.
And all this food is just to produce 100 watts. That's it. That's what we did. Mm. Yeah. But if you look at that relative to time, you'll see that it's a 3/4 power. So it's a sublinear growth, right? It's a sublinear power law. And that, so if you double the size of the animal, you do not double the, you only increase the metabolic rate by 75%, right?
Yeah.
So the bigger the animal, the more efficient it is. And it actually works for, you know, even like bacteria all the way up to like blue whales.
Yeah.
And there's also examples of the line.
Yeah. And there's also examples of how cities grow and their GDP or everything. Amount of businesses.
Yeah, like even number like that, of right? patents per capita, for example, things like that, right?
Wow. But
yeah.
And so the biggest question I have there, I think what I like about it, and it's also why I started talking to Giovanni. I saw his post on Reddit, and then
that you're talking to him. It's great.
I went down the power law rabbit hole, which was
great.
Fascinating. So, but what I find difficult with Bitcoin, and I hope to formulate the question right, like I see it as, of course, it's a network growing, right? It's a network of participants growing. So it's kind of like similar to perhaps kind of like Moore's law type-ish. But where does the power law of Bitcoin come from? Is that because it's basically like a mind virus? It's like a social adoption thing? Is it a human behavior type of element there? Or is it because Bitcoin is so rooted in math and physics as well? Like just how that is engineered? Does it make any sense to identify those two, or like how do you see that? Because that's
why would the number of patents per user, why would the number of patents increase sublinearly with the amount of users? It does. Okay. Mm-hmm. Sorry, it's superlinearly. So the amount of patents grows by 20%. It's true. It's a fact, right? Why is that? So why do these numbers show up? I don't know. It's just a normal growth kind of curve. Everything has, either they grow sublinearly or superlinearly at some rate.
Yeah. But is it irrelevant then to talk about this human behavior? Because the one thing I think about with the power laws of Bitcoin, right? Let's say in this bull run, we go to 500K plus, right?
Yeah.
There will be a bigger number of people that will pay attention to Bitcoin because of that than the amount of people that did at, you know, 10 cents to $10 or whatever.
Probably right? Not, but there will be, but
well,
not
that's relevant. The point. That's the point, right?
Not on a percentage basis, right?
Exactly.
So actually what these power laws suggest is that there's nothing new under the sun, right? So
yeah.
And everybody's like, well, ETFs are big, Fred. Like, I'm like, well, so was Mt. Gox when it came out, right? That was a big thing for Bitcoin to have an exchange, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
But at that point, within that context, with that amount of users, you say like,
exactly,
so it's not
right?
About the absolute numbers. It's more about the percentages. Yeah,
it's okay. Look, all these things, it doesn't really matter that there is now ETFs or it seems like that it's just a general function of time that doesn't depend on anything else. There's only one variable in it, which is time. That's the only variable.
Yeah. So basically,
there's nothing
long,
else.
Yeah, so this is what Jeff Booth says, right? As long as it stays decentralized and secure, it will be chugging along and people will adopt it as it goes, basically.
Yeah, there's nothing you or I can do that's going to change that or anybody else or ETFs or it's just a normal growth pattern, right?
Yeah.
And okay. I feel like, you know, the question is sort of why is it a power law? Well, because I think it's kind of a natural type phenomenon, right? It's a network type thing, but it's like cities are networks or, you know, animals are networks. We're networks of cells, right? That's kind of what we are. We're, you know, we have all these little cells that make us up, trillions of them.
Mm.
And for those cells, we don't exist, right? They're just like, they're doing their own thing.
Exactly. And, yeah, that's true.
You know, and so Bitcoin itself is, you know, the growth of Bitcoin as a store of value and stuff, it's clearly has its own clear path. And other cryptocurrencies don't, right? So if you look at Litecoin, for example, the price of Litecoin is not a power law.
Okay.
Right?
And
I mean, the price of Litecoin was... is lower than it was in 2017 right now.
Yeah. And would you
agree
that...
The adoption of Litecoin is not growing as a power law. So,
yeah.
You know.
But would you agree then, do you agree then that the price is like a proxy of the adoption also or not?
I think there's that's the crazy thing, which is that the price of Bitcoin was known to be a power law first, right? But then, you know, the hash rate of Bitcoin is also a power law. And furthermore, the amount of the usage of Bitcoin is a power law. So there's power laws everywhere in Bitcoin. It's not just price. There's all kinds of power laws. In fact, there's even power laws of power laws. So if you look at the amount of Bitcoin... that the growth rate of Bitcoin for Bitcoin wallets having one Bitcoin, 1/10 of a Bitcoin, 1/100 of a Bitcoin, et cetera, that's also a power law of Bitcoin. What I'm just trying to say is there's all these intrinsic power laws, which just tell you that you're looking at a network. You're looking at this growth of a network, and there's a lot of different ways you can look at it. And there's power laws at every single one of those points, right? Whether it's hash rate, whether it's usage, whether it's price, it's all connected.
And so what's the biggest difference with like the classic S-curve of technology adoption then here? Like, is that something we should let go? I mean, there's people that also follow that.
I mean, it's probably ultimately going to be an S-curve, right? But we're still in the very early phases, right? So, you know... I would say, roughly speaking, of kind of like, how close are we to the end? 1%, you know?
Yeah, we are at 1%, you mean? Yeah.
So, yeah, maybe. Okay. Maybe not even 1%, right?
So, yeah, I agree.
So when you look at
too early to talk about S-curve adoption then. But
right. Yeah. Well, a friend of mine, Stephen Perrineaud, he's an astrophysicist, right? And he's actually even modeled like S-curves that actually look like power laws in the very early phase.
Hmm.
They're identical to power laws, and then they turn into S-curves, right? So you can model these things with an S-curve, but realistically, we're probably 10 years away from the S-curve stuff even starting to become an S. You know, it looks like that, and then it sort of has an inflection point and it bends, right?
Yeah.
But we're still in the very early phases, you know. So we're 1% of the way in. I mean, realistically. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And probably in terms of time, we're, you know, we probably have at least one decade before we stop power law growth at all. Yeah.
Okay.
So we're going to grow pretty much exponentially for the next decade. I mean, very close to exponential.
And would this be your main argument against people who say, you know, Bitcoin is too volatile to be a predictable store of value? It kind of depends on what your time frame is then, right?
I think it's sort of like this. It's sort of like, here's the thing. If you're looking at an asset that is sort of growing at some linear rate, right? And it's oscillating around this linear rate, I would say, yeah, it's way too volatile, right? Like, why would I want an asset? If I said, okay, you can either invest in something that's going to go up 10% a year, almost guaranteed, right?
Mm.
Or you can get an asset that's going to grow 40% a year, plus or minus 40%. Now you're like, well, I'll take the 10%. I'll take the 10% for sure, right? Like my house on the canals in Netherlands, right? That thing's probably going to grow up 10% a year, maybe 7%, right? That sounds a lot safer than something that's going to might go down 40%, right? But that's not the correct way of looking at it. It's not like it's a linear thing that's going to be, it's actually an exponential thing, right? So because it's exponential, not linear, right? It's not just volatility around a linear path. It's volatility around an exponential path. So if somebody said, well, you have this exponential asset, which has some volatility around an exponential path, do you want that? You should be like, of course I want that. It's great. This thing's going to be the next Microsoft, right? I'm buying Microsoft in 1986. Great.
Mm.
Like, I don't care what the volatility is if I buy Microsoft at around 86. You know, Microsoft went up, 3,000 times from 1986 till now, you know? So Bitcoin is on a very high growth trajectory, right? And it's not just a linear growth. It's going to grow a lot, compounded really high, right?
Hmm.
So, you know, this is something that's going to go up 10x, 20x from where we are now. And so because it's going to go up 10x, 20x, you're going to get a massive amount of volatility because it's growing at the super linear way, you know, not just even x squared. It's growing at x to the power 6. So, you know, if you see something that's growing at x to the power 6, you absolutely should own that thing.
Yeah.
Right.
So what's
it's just you just have to get it in your head. This thing's growing at x to the power 6. Okay. I'm going to own that thing, you know.
That's huge. So what do you think about, then, last question about this, like people talk a lot about, you know, diminishing returns. Like if they look at the previous cycles, you see like there was like X 1000% up, then X 100% up, then like 110% up now. Is that going to go down? Because like in my mind, I don't know if they are going to go down, because at one point, if the adoption grows and people understand what this is, my logical reasoning is less people will sell into, you know, the boom and bust that will follow each other. Like
I can tell you what statistically it's doing, right? Statistically, the volatility, well, it's growing at an exponential rate. The a quasi-exponential rate. So a power law is very similar to an exponential rate, except the exponential curve is growing down. So in 2017, like the growth rate was 100%. Yeah. Now the growth rate's like 45%.
Mm.
Okay. In 20 years, the growth rate will be 20%. That's kind of what the power law tells you. So it's still going to be 30% growth in, you know, in 10 years. So it's still so it's still going to be a very, very high growth thing for 10 years.
Yeah.
You know, you're getting a very, very high growth thing. The volatility is going down a little bit, but not that much, right? So the volatility has gone from 0.3 in log terms to 0.25. Not even that much. So I think that realistically, we can expect, high volatility and high growth for the next decade. Yeah. And by the way, because we're now looking at these numbers on a much bigger scale, you know, I think it's going to look like it's going to be crazy. I mean, it's going to be like Bitcoin went from 500,000 to 200,000. You know what I mean? That's going to appear like people are just not going to get their heads around that, because it's going to seem so crazy going from 500,000 to 200,000. But that's only, you know, that's one standard deviation, right? That's like one standard deviation is I dropped by half.
Yeah.
Okay. That's not terrible. You know what I mean? Especially if I overshot on the upside, I might go from 500,000 to 125,000.
Yeah. I think that's what Giovanni says too, right? Like his downside is like half of the trend line, and his upside is like 1.5-ish or something, right? Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, we could go, you know, we could go well above the trend line, right? We could go two times. There's twice we've gone 2x the trend line,
yeah,
which then puts a downside to 75% drop, right? Yeah. So you could go down, you know, you could go up conceivably to 500,000, then drop to 125,000. It's really hard to get an intuitive number without looking at the actual math and looking at the thing in log space. Your intuition will be wrong all the time.
Yeah. Well, I think this is a great tool to help you remember what this is, right? To emphasize what this is, because I think you can study Bitcoin and you get to a certain understanding. I mean, this is what I do. Like I still feel it when the price goes down a bit, but then I just reiterate like, oh, this is the stuff I know and nothing's changed, right? Like nothing fundamentally changed.
Well, it's sort of like,
but this is the same thing.
If you learn to fly a plane, you have to learn to trust the instruments a little bit. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or driving a car, you know, you look at the speedometer, you look at like the RPM, you sort of see, you have to like trust a little bit in like, okay, this is what the past behavior, this is what I expect. Now I have to learn to trust the instruments a little bit.
Yeah.
And I think that's where you're going to get freaked out. If you don't have any basis for this stuff, you're just gonna be like, okay, went down a lot. Yeah, looks like it's going to zero. I'm out.
Yeah. All right. I have another subject. I saw you tweet about gold, and you know, some people argue against Bitcoin and say, you know, at least you can hold gold physically and you can store it physically. Like you cannot do that with Bitcoin. Like I would argue that Bitcoin is like metaphysical, you know, but in fact it's also tangible because, you know, it's just math, and the fact that letters and numbers represent all the Bitcoin there is, like in some way it is tangible, and I can write down a private key with a pen on a paper and that can represent real, like you can hold $1 billion in your hands. Like how do you view this when people say this? Like
it just seems to me the person who said that is the head of Goldman Sachs' wealth management unit.
Well, what else?
So
would you say,
it's like, okay, something is wrong if she thinks that you can't hold Bitcoin. It just, to me, it's like, it's insane that somebody who has that position, right, who's advising literally trillions of dollars of money, that she does not understand even that you can hold Bitcoin in a wallet.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's the amount of just lack of understanding is just unbelievable to me, you know.
But is this as a Wall Street veteran, is this on purpose? Like, do they not understand? Like, I agree, right? Like, if this is your life, if this is your work, and there's a new form of money that is adopted by your biggest competitors, in a sense, how I mean, I worked in TradFi as well. I cannot imagine there's a research team researching this, right? Like, are they so ignorant?
Yeah.
Really? Is this just show?
Look.
Like, what else would they say? That's what I mean.
There's a lot of people who don't like to get their hands dirty. You know, I'll tell you a funny story. I sold a company to a social network, to Viacom. Okay. You know, it was a pretty significant, you know, amount of money, like mid eight figures, you know. And, and I talked to the CFO of Viacom, Viacom's MTV, right? And I'm like, have you ever tried our product? And he's like, no. He goes, no, I don't do that. I don't actually try things. And I'm like, I know, but I've been like in due diligence for like 6 months with you. We do all these meetings. You do this, you know, dozens of lawyers, all this stuff. We've worked on all these fine prints of this. Have you never even actually created a profile? I don't care if it's a real one under your own name or whatever. But have you? And he goes, no, absolutely not. I'm not a guy doing social networking. And I think the same thing is true for Goldman Sachs. I mean, I guarantee you that woman has not created a Bitcoin wallet. Now, she can pontificate all she wants about Bitcoin wallets, but she doesn't know what a Bitcoin wallet is. She's never actually stored Bitcoin. Otherwise, she wouldn't be saying that. It's typical, you know. I'll leave that to some younger people. They'll do the actual work. I'll just read some article, and I'll make some statements.
Yeah.
How
do you view BlackRock getting into this? Like, my idea here is, I kind of see the Bitcoin adoption of, well, at least a part of Wall Street, kind of like a Trojan horse, in a sense. Like, for me, it's very fascinating that a huge winner of the fiat financial system, you know, is already one leg into this new money system. I mean, like, usually the winners move last, right? They milk their cash cow, and then they move on, kind of like, well, this Goldman Sachs lady or Vanguard, right? Like, these people, they're just pushing this away. But I think that's what British Huddle, I heard him once say, like, if you don't think there's like a team of 50 people figuring out what this Bitcoin thing is for the past 2 years or 5 years at BlackRock, you know, you're crazy. And I definitely agree. Like, they totally understand what this is. Of course, they can make money off it, so they make a product for it, etc. But still, the fact that they actually moved here, for me, is a very big signal, because the winners usually move last, right? Like, so how do you see this comparison to like these firms that don't move and actually talk against it, and these other firms? Well, if you hear Larry Fink talk, it's wild. Yeah. Totally.
Well, especially if you listen to him talk like 5 years ago.
Exactly. Right? Yes. Yeah.
Right. So he completely has 180. You know, apparently it's some young guy working at BlackRock who Orange built him.
Yeah.
Mitch Nick. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, look, I think it's, you know, it is like this. It's somebody, you know, it's a personal thing. You know, I think Larry Fink personally got it, you know. He personally understood this stuff, whereas I don't think he personally understood it 5 years ago. You know what I mean? So yeah, I do think he was orange-pilled in the kind of conventional sense. And he was like, okay. And not just for Bitcoin, right? But I think, like, you know, he has this idea of tokenization and, you know, stocks and so on, on the blockchain, which, you know, I don't think even is a bad idea longer term. But what I'm saying is, like, I think I think he realized that this is the future, and he better get on board and own this future.
Yeah.
Before somebody else decides to do it to him. Yeah. So,
well, maybe easier in some sense for him that he's the founder of this firm, of course, and then, you know, the woman at Goldman Sachs or the CEO of Vanguard is not. So maybe there's also a different kind of like structure there, of course, as to how.
I mean, I've met Larry Fink. I mean, I actually worked for him for a day, you know. Mm-hmm. So back in the day. So yeah. So look, I mean, he's a very, very smart guy, and you know, he's a visionary, not just, and he's a visionary. He was a visionary in terms of financialization of assets, you know, creating the first CMO. That was an absolutely masterful move, you know, doing that with Lou Ranieri, who was at Salomon at the time, or I was. And, you know, and then embracing ETFs, you know, and buying iShares. He bought iShares from Barclay, right? Mm. So, you know, that was seeing that ETFs were the future was, you know, critical, right? And so I think, you know, it's similar to Bezos realizing that e-commerce is going to be huge, right? But when he did.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I think he has the right view of, wait a second, what's the most important thing? ETFs are the most important thing. Boom. I'm going to get an ETFs. I'm going to provide super low cost friction ETFs for everything.
Yeah.
Brilliant. So, I mean, that's, you know, he saw that, he did that. Right. And that's what kind of BlackRock made its mark, really, you know, as, you know, the ETF, superstore. Yeah. Right.
Well, and if you keep on this view of that you have of Larry Fink, like I have I don't know if it's a strange theory, but I have a certain theory, and maybe it's too big and it doesn't make sense. But what I'm thinking from my point of view, but I think you can add to this, like the you know, the speculative attack story of George Soros and the Bank of England, right?
Yeah.
Larry Fink knows what's up with the dollar, I assume, right? He totally understands this, right? Would you say, could this already be like some sort of speculative attack on the dollar in a sense that he has this like one leg in this new money system that, let's say, when the dollar actually breaks, that he is already with one leg in a certain lifeboat, which also gives him a certain amount of influence, right? I mean, yesterday we saw the U.S. government again sell 30,000 Bitcoin, like they're selling it like crazy. Could this be something like that?
Look, he knows more than anybody else, right? Because kind of when QE happened, right? And then you know, the latest kind of, you know, the latest version of QE came, they said, hey, BlackRock, you're going to do all the bond buying for us, right? You know, so he's got the front row seat. So he sees the problem way before we do and much closer than we do. So, yeah, I don't know if he's trying to attack the dollar so much as I think he has a better view of kind of the problems and the current system than anybody.
Yeah.
And I think he realizes that this is going to be a very, very significant asset class for the next 10 years. I think that these guys think 10 years in advance, you know, and I think that it's sort of like the Japanese used to do those, you know, 5-year plans and stuff. I think they've now shifted. They're like, okay, Bitcoin and crypto, right? I think he's definitely thinking both, and, you know, tokenization, you know, let's see, you know, if they don't allow ETH this year, fine, we'll just wait until next year or 2 years from now when they, you know, maybe it's a new head of the SEC, maybe it's a new president, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I definitely think that, I mean, I think he's in it for the long game, right?
Yeah.
And so.
Yeah. 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 I think perhaps attack was a
not really attack.
Too hard word. Was a too hard word, but it is a certain strategy against it, I'd say, if you adopt this new money, Right. But it's just interesting to think about. I think it's just interesting. He moved anyway. So, yeah, for me, that's a big signal.
But I definitely think that if you had any question about whether it's going to be, is Bitcoin going to survive, the fact that BlackRock has put their, you know, their stake in the ground tells you that 100% is going to survive. Like, yeah, there's no doubt in my mind, right?
Yeah, I agree. And this is also how I always saw Bitcoin. It was an experiment, I'd say. And it would go to zero, or it would be like the black hole value type theory. And it's not going to zero anymore. So I agree with that. But yeah, I think the outlook should be long, right? You should have like a long-term vision. And that's actually, I want to ask you a question about this, because I saw you tweeted something that I really agreed with. And you said, I was a TradFi degen, like a degenerate. Then slowly I kicked the habit. And instead of trading or making bets, I moved into long-term investing. Yeah. I also saw that you had like a crypto-related project before with a token. I mean, I made a crypto market research platform that failed before, you know, like we dabbled around in this too. But how did you move from being a degen, a degenerate, to being like a long-term investor, et cetera?
You know, I built a wallet for crypto, you know, called Lynx. And so I was I was convinced back in 2018, 2019, that, you know, if the sort of the multi-coin Solana type thesis, fast, super fast, blah, 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 is good. I'm still not anti-token or anti any of these things. I think, you know, I'm not, I just think that I'm a Bitcoin maximalist in that I think no other coin is going to be money, right? There's no possibility that, you know, people start, you know, having prices in ETH in the next 10 years. You know, nobody's going to do oil settlements in ETH. It's just not going to happen, right? Or Solana or anything else, right? Those are not going to become world money. They are going to be useful. There's a lot of use for some things like this. They're just not money, right? And so the way I look at it is, you know, a lot of these things are actually useful for, and I mean, even NFTs are quite, people like them, right? They're useful. They can be used for art. They can be used for a lot of things potentially, right? We're still at the very beginning of that. And, you know, like Larry Fink's vision of tokenization, you know, I have a friend who's doing, you know, property thing, Natalie from Proppy, right? She's doing, you know, real estate on the blockchain. You know, it's still very early days, but she's doing it. She's, you know, they've had apartment buildings or houses that have been sold, you know, entirely the whole chain of command is, you know, title, everything on blockchain. So I'm not anti-token, and I think, you know, a lot of people are saying, well, Fred, you're a maxi, you can't support other tokens. No, you can. It's just, I just don't think they're going to compete for money, right?
Yeah, it's a different thing.
They're a different thing, and it's this much smaller thing, right? Like, to me, like, creating a new form of money for the entire planet, well, that's, you know, that's a $100 trillion prize, right? Now, creating a token for NFTs, I don't know, maybe that's a couple hundred million, maybe, you know, like if you're lucky, like OpenSea, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's not to say it's bad. You can certainly do it. But I think it's not, I think the, you know, you have to look at where is the eye on the price, you know? So I think, you know, and I think the big prize is Bitcoin, right? That's the prize is money. Now, if you have a 5% of your money spread around a bunch of stuff, you buy some NFTs for art, do whatever you want, fine, great, do that. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not a maximalist in the kind of Spanish Inquisition sense of the word, you know? I don't want to, like, sorry, man, you bought an NFT. Bad, like, no. buy a little ETH, so what, you know? Use MetaMask, it's not the end of the world, right? But I don't think it's a great use of your money to invest, especially if somebody doesn't own any Bitcoin, if they're buying some meme coin or something else.
Yeah.
It's kind of a mistake, right? Now, you know, if you own a lot of Bitcoin and you're also like playing around, you want to do something else, you want to buy Dogecoin, fine, buy Dogecoin. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
have fun, you know, like
you should view it in different ways, I think.
Like, you have to view it in different ways. And also, it's like, and the other part of being a degen is trying to time Bitcoin. Like, really bad idea, I think. Mm.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, like trying to buy and sell Bitcoin constantly is just not a good idea. Right? But
why do you think people are so degenerate with their money, or like on this gambling vibe in a sense? Like, why? Why is
you
that?
You know, people seem to think that they can outsmart the market, you know, and I think it's a combination of greed and fear. You know, I think people think, I'm going to be able to sell Bitcoin and then buy it back cheaper. Well, generally speaking,
I did that twice.
Yeah.
Two times, bad idea.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Did you?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think generally speaking, if you sell it, you're probably not going to be able to buy it back cheaper, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you know, you probably think you will, but then it'll go down. Maybe it'll go down, but then you're going to be convince yourself that you shouldn't buy it until it goes back up above where you bought it. And then you're going to be like, oh, damn.
Yeah. 100%.
You know, so I think psychologically it's a really bad idea to kind of actively trade this stuff. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's a terrible idea to spend your Bitcoin, you know, like, you know, ultimately you're going to be spending it somehow, right? You're going to be using it to do something with it, right? But that's different than trying to sell it and buy it back, right?
Yeah.
So if I'm like, okay, great, now it's time for me to buy a house because I just got married and I need to sell a little bit of my Bitcoin to buy the house. Okay, well, sell a little bit of Bitcoin. I mean, you got to live. You got to, you know what I mean? I think that makes sense. And, you know, I think, try to postpone it as much as you can, but, you know, also you're going to live. You know, you're not living forever anyways, you know, so.
That's true. But you what would be your biggest tip for someone? Like, how can someone develop this long-term view and basically also like trust themselves with their understanding of, well, we're talking about Bitcoin, right? But at one point
don't use leverage. Do not use leverage, right?
Yeah.
Because if you have too much of something, if you're using leverage, I think psychologically, you can get wrecked too easily. The second thing is I wouldn't put all your money in Bitcoin. And the reason I say that is I still think your best percentage, the best kind of percentage of your asset, like even fully invested to me, I think that's like 70% Bitcoin. You know what I mean? Like even if I'm a young person, I would keep 30% in cash. Mm. I'd actually put it in like something super safe, like a bank account, you know? And the reason is that there's always unexpected things in life, you know, like whether it's, you know, you get sick, you get hit by a car, something, you know, something happens, you know, you have a kid and the kid needs some operation or something, right?
Yeah.
And, or you lose your job, right? And you have 3 months where you're not working, right? I think a lot of, especially a lot of young people, underestimate those risks. And those risks are real. So having cash that you can sell, that you can use beyond just Bitcoin is good, because you never know if something happens like that and you get caught in like 2022, you're going to sell all your Bitcoin, right, to pay for it.
Yeah, so, I agree.
I don't think it's a great idea. I mean, I think you have to realize that things can, you know, things can happen, and it's good. And so, you know, one of the things that I've done in my life is I've always had a very barbell strategy, you know, where I have some stuff that's very risky, like a startup, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's risky and takes cash. And then I have a lot of cash on the side, too, you know, just because, you know, I don't need to have. Like, if you're 70% in Bitcoin, you can have all the rest in cash. No problem. You don't need to invest the rest. Put the rest in a bank account. You know what I mean?
Well, I'm at 90-10, so.
Okay, well, 90-10, look, if you can handle 90-10, good. It depends, like, if you have a job and you have everything else, you know, 90-10 is probably okay. If you don't, you know, if you're just, like, counting on this Bitcoin and you, I just think a lot of people are cutting it a little too close to the edge, you know.
And yeah,
it's a personal decision, but that's I think a tip that I would say is don't try to optimize too much, and I would say I think these power laws and stuff are good for giving people a little bit more perspective on, like, numbers.
Yeah.
Not for trading so much, but just, like, you know, like, to give you a little bit of belief, to reinforce your belief that, wait a second, if I wait 5 years, is this thing really going to be much higher? Probably will, right? Probably it's going to be triple where it is today, more. It may be quadruple, right? But, like, you know, I think a lot of that is just giving you the conviction that you need to hold something, you know, because no matter what, Bitcoin can go down 10% in a day. And we saw it the other day, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, things can move a lot and not getting freaked out about it is I think. Now, having said that, I another tool is just, you know, dollar cost average. You know, like if you do have cash coming in regularly, well, great, just plop that cash into Bitcoin. You know,
yeah,
that's another good tool because then you don't have to think about it too much, right? So it's like, oh, I just made $1,000. Great, I'll just put it in Bitcoin, right?
Yeah, just view it as a savings vehicle, right? Yeah,
a savings vehicle, right?
Yeah.
And I think that makes total sense, especially for a young person right now. Like, I think that's a lot of that's a good thing. And I would say the other thing is just, you know, and this is something I think you become more as a Bitcoiner. You start realizing that having Bitcoin is such a good thing to have that you cut down on sort of stupid expenses.
Yes.
Right. Maybe I don't need a new car. You know,
yes,
maybe I can live in my current wherever I'm living without upgrading that, you know.
Yeah,
I mean, that's, I think a buying a house effect, for example, is probably I own my house, but I wouldn't, if I was doing it right now today, and I was, especially if I was younger, I would definitely rent for 5 years as opposed to buying a house right now.
Yeah.
I think
it's interesting, you know, that this is what a lot of people experience. This more, they kind of like this frugality in some sense. They become more frugal, or at least more aware of what things cost or what is the value of something that I buy. Like, does it add value to my life? You know, stuff like that. You become more aware.
Yeah, and there's one other thing I would say is start thinking in Bitcoin.
Yeah.
How much Bitcoin is this?
Yeah.
Don't think in terms of I have, you know, so much dollars. But just think, I've got so much. I got 3 Bitcoin. Okay, I got 3.1 Bitcoin. You know, I want to get to 4. You know, like, how do I get to 4? Like, you know, that's
also, if you think about that big purchase, right? If you put price that into Bitcoin,
I would definitely think in Bitcoin. I think that is a significant hack to helping people. You know. And I think that's one of the big advantages of Bitcoin relative to other things, because nobody really thinks in Ethereum. Like, they don't think, they're like, oh, I got so much dollars of Ethereum. Nobody thinks of, like, I got 20 Ether, you know?
Yeah.
Or I get 10,000, you know, 4,000 Solana. This is like, I've got so much dollars worth of Solana, right?
Yeah,
but like
exactly.
Bitcoin is different because, you know, Bitcoin is, it really is this unit, you know, the units of Bitcoin. The other thing I would say is definitely, and I know some people may not agree with this, but I would definitely get used to buying and selling, but get used to using Bitcoin wallets and transacting with Bitcoin. Even if it's small amounts, I think that's another thing I would recommend everybody do. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, you know, use Lightning, use Bitcoin wallets. Don't just put it in one thing and just forget about it. You know?
Yeah.
I think getting involved a little bit, and you don't have to go crazy. You know, you don't have to go looking for one restaurant in your town that accepts Bitcoin, but it's not necessarily a bad idea to do that a little bit. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Well, it's fun to see the technology in action. I try to use it.
Look, it's just sort of like you need to remember. It's one of these things. Is if you don't exercise, you lose muscle, right?
Mm.
And I think it's useful. Like it's useful to actually do trades and send people Bitcoin and send a friend Bitcoin. I owe you some money here. I'll give you some Bitcoin. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like I feel like people should remember this is a peer-to-peer transaction test. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I recommend people in the US, you know, we have this Cash App thing here, and I say everybody should use Cash App and, you know, get in the mode of stuff. And, you know, you want to buy an, like, I'm in favor of these ordinals and stuff. You know, you want to buy an ordinal or something, go do it, you know, and you don't spend a lot of money, but just, you know, get a little bit used to things, moving things in Bitcoin, you know, familiarize yourself with block, you know, mempool, you know, understand how Bitcoin works. And I think that once you get in, I think you really, you don't want to go any other place, you know, like you're like, I like the Bitcoin world. I like blocks. I like having a block. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
I like checking block times. I like, you know, I like all these things. And all these things are part of Bitcoin to me. And I think, you know, being part of that world and really being into that world and really understanding the difference between SegWit and Taproot and these type of addresses and, you know, all this stuff will help you become a better Bitcoin, you know?
Yeah, I agree.
So I think that that's, you know, like I would use every single Lightning wallet that exists. I would test out 10 different wallets and, you know, try moving some money between them, you know?
Yeah.
Try different custody solution. Don't just do one and then just leave it and let it sit for 2 years and then realize you didn't actually store your words properly or something, you know? So I think just usage is very important.
Yeah.
And, you know, and join a Bitcoin meetup groups and, you know.
Yeah.
That those things I think are important, you know. And
I actually got my hairdresser onto Bitcoin, so now every time I go, I pay him in Bitcoin. So that's good.
See, that's the thing. Even paying somebody on-chain Bitcoin is not terrible. You know, it's not, you know, the fees are actually kind of reasonable right now, you know what I mean? So
yeah, I agree.
And so I think that
I love Bitcoin.
I love the whole ecosystem of Bitcoin. So, like, there's nothing about any of part of it that I don't like, you know?
Yeah.
And so, but I know there's a lot of people who, well, for example, we were doing this one space, and, you know, this guy, Gary Cardone, we had this bet, and he lost this bet, and this Bitcoin Beagle guy won. And then Gary's like, okay, he goes, okay, you're paying 100,000 sats. And he was like, I don't know how to send 100,000 sats. I'm like, wait a second. Like, you have Bitcoin, right? And he goes, yeah, well, Coinbase, you know? I don't like, okay, you got to learn how to send Bitcoin.
Yeah.
You don't know how to send Bitcoin. You're not a Bitcoiner. I mean, what are you doing on the Bitcoin space?
Mm-hmm.
You know, talking about Bitcoin for hours on the end when you actually can't, if you can't send somebody 100,000 sats like that, you need to do your homework a little bit. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So,
well, I think it's the summary is like study Bitcoin in breadth and depth, right? And you try everything out. And I think that's also, well, for me, it's what's fun. It's like I'm learning every day still. This is such a huge thing. And so every day there's a new topic to learn or a thing to try out. So that's always just very rewarding.
There's a lot
I
of
think.
Cool tools out there. And there's a lot exactly. of, you know, there's a lot of good projects and cool tools and you know, it's interesting too. And I think that, you know, part of it is if you stay interested in these things, you become a better holder of this stuff because
yeah.
it's like, okay, this is kind of what I'm, this is all relates to my passion, which is this Bitcoin, right?
Yeah.
So that's what I think.
All right, Fred, to wrap up the last question.
Yeah.
And I ask everyone the same question.
Oh,
what is a core belief you will never let go?
A core belief that I will never let go. A core belief about Bitcoin?
Anything.
Okay. I think my core belief is that you really need to do it yourself. You need to be hands-on and you have to make up your own mind. And not accept other people's opinion, but just make up your own mind about these things. Like it's not good enough to be like, well, Saylor said it, you know, mm-hmm. or so-and-so said it, or Fred said it, or Fred said power law. Like, no, you should 100% convince yourself of whatever you're thinking. But you have to go through all the work yourself and you have to convince yourself and you should make up your own mind because that's the only way you're going to have really strong convictions, I think.
Love that. Yeah.
So that's kind of what
couldn't agree more, I'd say.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is also what Bitcoin invites you to do, right? I think that's the whole point. Like you don't have to believe what people like us say about Bitcoin. The entire idea is that we invite you so you can study it because it's so transparent that you don't have to believe us. That's the entire point, right? But you have to do that work, as you said.
Well, like, that's why I love it so much because from my perspective, it's so mathematical. It's just so transparent.
Yeah.
And, you know, I love that every little thing is like even in Ethereum, they're not even sure how many Ether there are. Nobody's even sure. Like, something's wrong with that system, right? When they can't even tell you how many there is, you know?
Yeah, and they're changing it again. Well,
and they're changing it again. Like, I don't know. Like, to me, there's something fundamentally wrong with Bitcoin. It's just, it's black and white. And, you know, there's no sort of real mysteries there. It's all, you know, there's mysteries as to why it's working the way it is. And, you know, like, it is kind of, it almost feels like it's an alien force, you know. It's like this thing was created and it's just working so well and it's taking over the world in such a way.
Hmm.
I don't know why that is exactly. Why is it so, you know, it just seems like it was created once, one code, changed a little bit, but not much, you know.
Yeah. I think it's because it just works. It sounds so stupid, but it works and everyone can check it out. And I think maybe to add to what you said, like if you're studying Bitcoin, like one of the things to keep an eye on is, you know, the halving that's coming up. That's not just like, the block rewards are split in half, but this is actually like a celebration of the fact that we can trust the rules that are set out for this monetary system, right? If the halving happens on the date that we predict, that actually shows you that the monetary policy of this system is true and enforced and adopted by everyone who uses it, right? That's the entire point. And I think that's a nice illustration of, I think, what we studied and now believe in. So,
well, Bram, it's great talking to you. And, you know, if I'm ever in Netherlands, I'll look you up.
Hit me up.
And if you're ever in LA, let's come by.
Let's do it. Well, thanks so much for your time in this conversation. And we'll stay in touch.
Okay, cheers. Thanks, Bram.
Thank you. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, it would be amazing if you could rate, review, and subscribe on the podcast platform of your choice. It will help us educate more millennials on the importance of Bitcoin. You can follow and connect with me on Twitter. I'm Bram K. That's at BRAMK. And if you are or know someone who has an interesting perspective on Bitcoin that's worth sharing, hit me up. I read and reply to every single message. I appreciate your support and hope you'll be here for the next episode. Thanks for listening. Bye.